This morning, I really want to talk a short period of time and leave a lot of time for questions and answers, or perhaps some equal time, around the theme of leading into the new normal. This is a phrase I think you're hearing more and more as the financial markets reset, as the state keeps taking money from us, and as the schools and departments see less state funding. And I want to talk a little bit about what that is, because we've been through a lot of change in the last 5 years. It's kind of not a new thing. It's a chronic condition, but I'm going to say to you, we have moved into an acute condition because the pace is intense, and this whole institution is undergoing a reevaluation. This was a long discussion for us at the president's retreat 2 weeks ago. It's been a subject at the dean's retreat, and I think it's going to end up more and more as we work this down through the schools. There are three core questions. What do we do? How do we do it? And why do we do it? And it's kind of a period of renewal around the land-grant mission, and really gets to the question, should we continue to be involved in such a broad array of education, research, and outreach or clinical care? So I'm going to talk a little bit about the impact of that hard look at where we are as an institution, talking about the budget, improving efficiency of operations, clinical relationships with Fairview and others, about research corridors and how we're going to capture that value. And finally, we're going to talk about the creativity and innovation and leadership that we will need to emerge into the new normal tomorrow. Now, if you ask me tomorrow, I'll tell you it's tomorrow. I don't know exactly what the timeline of tomorrow is. I do think, though, it's a time to reflect on what it is that is our foundation for moving forward. And I think any time one gets into periods of rapid change or change of great magnitude, you fall back on two things. What's your mission and what are your core values? And that's what has to drive who we are and where we go in the future. First, our mission. The core of our mission is to educate and train the next generation of doctors, pharmacists, dentists, advanced practice nurses, veterinarians, public health professionals, and our allied health professionals that we train in OT, CLS, PT, etc., to serve the people of Minnesota and to improve the health of communities. That is our core mission that we are charged by the state of Minnesota to fulfill. For us, fulfilling that mission of producing workforce is a duty. That's very different than a lot of the rest of the university, where producing workforce is clearly needed for the state of Minnesota, but there are many other sources for that workforce. It's also our role to sustain and promote the vitality of health research. Recall, the state of Minnesota said there is only one state research institution. That is the University of Minnesota. It is us for health research. Now, we can partner with other people, and we do partner with Mayo Clinic as another academic health center, but ultimately it is our duty to produce the research that moves health forward. And the third part of our mission is to enhance and support the economic vitality of the state, primarily in its health industries, and as I'll come to later, this biomedical sciences development for the state of Minnesota. This mission hasn't changed for years and years and years. Its most recent strategic affirmation was in the year 2000 Academic Health Center Strategic Plan and its update in 2005. So what are the values that we really need in this. And I'm not going to give you all of them, but there are a couple that I think are important. We live our obligations to the citizens of Minnesota. This is not just a mission. It's our responsibility, and we are accountable for it. If you doubt that, I'll get you involved in the state legislature in the next session, because you'll hear it there. You'll hear it if you go around the communities of Minnesota. What are you doing for my health? And why aren't you producing more of this and more of that and those kinds of things? We also need to understand most of Minnesota is still federally classified as underserved in dentistry, pharmacy, primary care, mental health, and certain specialties, such as general surgery. So we're not through this workforce challenge yet. Number two, we rely on the goodwill of our partners in hospitals and community clinics throughout in the state or region. We rely on them for our ability to educate 6,000 students in our health professional schools. Without them, we have no place to train them. There are 1,700 plus affiliation agreements with clinical performance sites just in the state of Minnesota. We need them going forward. So we have kind of a tricky balance to maintain. On the one hand, we must compete effectively in the marketplace with everybody else who's looking for contracts in the marketplace. And as we move through healthcare reform, our ability to do that is what will be tested. Can we leverage our internal assets for success? There is no other place that has doctors, nurses, pharmacists, public health practitioners, etc., under one roof. Our ability to take care of populations is what's coming down the road. And we need to figure out how to do that. At the same time, we have a duty and an obligation and a partnership that's necessary for educating the next generation of health professionals and for making the discoveries we do public information. That's the balance that's going to become increasingly challenged as we move forward, and particularly challenged when we move more and more into this integration with Fairview that I'll speak about again. We're a public research university, so how do we generally compete? In the short version, you've heard me say, we outrun them. We do it better, we do it faster, and we do it smarter in the marketplace. And that's where we've got to go in order to correctly and effectively use one of our most important assets, the imprimatur of the University of Minnesota, our brand. So that's important for us to understand. So there are some interesting characteristics of this new normal. Intense public interest in transparency. Intense public interest in engaging in the discussion of who we are and where we're going. Intense public interest in fairness and equity, particularly for access. And intense public concern about elitism. And you'll see that more as you pay attention to the anti-intellectualism and anti-science that is, in fact, very much alive. This is not a new concept, it's just the pendulum has swung. So what does this mean? What does this mean to the public? The public is worried about big institutions where it's hard for them to get information on, that are making decisions without public comment or input, who are demonstrating any sort of unfair or inequitable behavior, and that has a veneer of elitist arrogance, parentheses, ivory tower, parentheses, close. So this is our environment. We've actually made some significant gains, but it also means we need to put out as much information as possible in ways people can receive it and understand it. We need to provide forums like this that engage us in discussions and the public in discussions. We need to regularly demonstrate our fairness, and we need to break down the walls of the academy by being open, clear, candid, straightforward, and willing to engage in dialogue and compromise. That's our challenge internally. So, I want to make a few comments about four or five areas as I move through this. First, on financing. It's a reality. Over the next 2 years, the state will pull $140 million out of the base budget of this institution. That is not biennial accounting. That is dollars removed, gone, never to come back. In the last piece of this rescission, the $75 or $80 million, the Academic Health Center took about 25% of that, and you've all seen that in your schools. There's another $50 million coming in 2011, and as of now, the projected biennial deficit for the next biennium runs between $6 and $7.5 billion. I simply say this to you because our least reliable, if you like confidence limits, our least reliable source of revenue is state money. And in this institution, the tuition revenue exceeds the state money. This will forever change who we are and what we do. And you will not be able to rely on state money as your source of revenue for investment. That's a problem because it's recurring money. So this is moving us in a direction that we need to really think about our internal model, and I'll have a couple of comments on that. We're getting some additional money through the legislative pathway of the stimulus money. You are all getting stimulus money directly in many of the opportunities that have been available. But I would submit to you the legislative stimulus money that we are now supporting a lot of tuition on creates the great step in the next biennium. So if you're replacing with one-time money $450 per student in tuition, that goes away in 2012. We're raising tuition an effective 3% because of that stimulus support. This is primarily undergraduate. It goes away in 2010. Now, we've done a lot of things. I mean, none of us are getting a raise. A bunch of other stuff. Fortunately, we could preserve most of the health benefits. Give you one example. Our former president, Mark Udoff, has cut faculty and staff salaries 10% across the University of California using a furlough system. We're not doing that. I'm philosophically opposed to that. There were a lot of internal financial promises that were made. They had to be delayed, or in some cases, we simply can't meet them. We're looking at what really drives costs. Why does it cost so much to provide health professional education and a degree to our students? What drives that? Why is it? Can we achieve the same in fewer years and lower cost? Is our compensation really in line? Are we appropriately managing the shared cost pools of this large institution? Are we managing the cost of new buildings? Is our appetite for space exceeding our ability to pay for it? Have we truly accounted for the cost of conducting research? You've all heard the expression, NIH money requires a 25 to 30% cross subsidy to pay for the cost of research. We have almost a $400 million research portfolio in the Academic Health Center. Do the math. $125 million has to come from somewhere to support the research. Those are issues we have never fully cost accounted. I will tell you straight out, We have never fully cost-accounted the cost of education or the cost of instruction. And we're going to have to move into that and develop the systems that do that. Will business and industry continue to seek research results from academic institutions? And will we really be able to maintain the research infrastructure that is needed to do that? You all hear about the ISOs that are there for mass spec and protein analysis and genomics and all of those kinds of things. How do we turn that over, renew it? How do we really go ahead and get the optical imaging that our faculty really need and deserve? We have to solve those problems. For education, are we at the limit of what our students can afford for health professional degree? If Medicare and Medicaid dollars are no longer fund medical education, graduate medical education, what do we do? Can we continue to count on 1,700 hospitals, clinics, and institutions throughout Minnesota to support the education of our students? What if they want to be paid for it? Have we really put out their performance criteria that we expect from them? And how do we make this transition to e-learning? If you haven't seen it, the Federal Department of Education has released its meta-analysis of 1,000 studies on e-learning. Unequivocal, the students learn better, faster, and retain more. It's out on their website. If you need the URL, we'll send it out. It's worth reading. We are behind that transition. Clinically, can we achieve the efficiencies we seek with our Fairview partners and compete more effectively in the health marketplace? Can we change the way we work with communities to truly engage them in the development of our translational research? And how will healthcare reform proposals truly affect the process of health that we will play in and how we actually generate the revenue from that to support our schools? Efficient and effective operations has really been a major emphasis for the first time in this institution, and you'll hear more and more from the president about this. I'll give you some pieces of information. We started this fiscal year July 1 with an 8% budget reduction in the administrative service budgets of the Academic Health Center and its schools and programs, and a minimum of 5% budget cuts in schools. That's to balance the state rescission. It does not balance all of the school and departmental and division budgets, and it does not solve the structural deficit that is still underneath it. In this new process, I'll say a few more words about, as we've combined the administration of my office and the medical school, we're in the process of reducing the administrative expenses about $2.5 million, and there's a lot more on the drawing boards that we will achieve. We're midway through an analysis of the Academic Health Center services, including IT, HR, Office of Education, Facilities and Communications, and putting in the process improvements so that there's productivity increase, improvements in customer satisfaction, and reductions in effective cost. I would submit to each of you in your schools, you need to be about the business of doing this. That's on the administrative platform. I will emphasize again later, you save a dollar, you keep a dollar. That's the incentive. We're going to have to do more when it comes to programs, and I'll address that in a minute. We're entering an important part of our relationship with Fairview and getting down to brass tacks to determine how close we should or want to be as institutions. I will be very clear on one point that keeps coming up. We will not, I repeat, not become employees of Fairview. Clear? There's a great fear about that. I hear this buzz. We're working with KSA Consulting to facilitate that work. Many of you will be interviewed, to see if an integrated clinical enterprise among Fairview UMP physicians and the university is feasible. And by the end of September 09, we will have identified the common and specific tangibles of a new integrated entity. We will have identified the results and outcomes we want to achieve, and we will have engaged in many of the operational details that one needs to do. The other thing that's clear, if and when we accomplish that, we will still need 1,700 plus affiliations with clinical entities to fulfill our education mission. And the mission of translational science comes to roost on the statewide clinical research network that we are establishing. Complex? Yeah, no question about that. Requires smart people thinking smartly, and this institution has the top 10% of that. Smart people. We're going to need to use that. An integrated health system branded with the university name is a concept that has the potential to really help position us in the marketplace to enhance our success, irrespective of what happens with healthcare reform. That's the upside. Research corridors remain a key concept for us amongst the faculty, not just in health sciences, but across the university. Each of our faculty approaches research differently, some by discipline, some by personality, some by background. However, within a corridor, the question that drives the research should be focused on improving health. I've said this before. The value of research in a health sciences center is its application to prevent, treat, and cure disease, animal and human. We've clearly identified such areas as diabetes, infectious disease, immunology, neurosciences, cardiology, cancer. So our challenge is to capture the promise of that expertise with supportive facilities and an infrastructure that helps research move into the clinical service lines and becomes available across the state of Minnesota and beyond. Our Clinical and Translational Science Institute has really geared up once more under Bruce Blazer's direction to hit the October deadline with a winning grant. Translational science and clinical scientists are critical to our future. Because of that commitment, this academic health center, with help from the university, has a recurring budget of $11 million that is now being utilized in the Clinical and Translational Science Institute, which is open and running. I hope we get the NIH grant. I think we will, and it builds on that base. The highlight coming down the road is the Biomedical Discovery District. A spade is in the ground on the CMRR expansion of about $45 or $50 million. The other facilities, one supporting research in oncology, one supporting translational research in cardiology, or cardiac disease, I should say, are now working with the faculty teams, the architects, the designers, and our project manager, Rick Johnson, and we will have the pre-design done by November of this year, a report to the state, and a shovel in the ground a year from now. The other piece you should know is that with a lot of help from Mr. Fitzenruder, the Vice President for Finance, Beth, myself, we've been working with the President, and we now have an agreement on the financial model to finish paying for those facilities and to populate them with faculty. So we have a go here and a major opportunity that the rest of the country is very envious about. The state picks up 75% of this cost. We pay 25%. You should also know that upwards of $2 billion of money from outside the state is looking to be spent inside this state in privately developed accelerators and biosciences parks for new startup companies. So this is an enviable position to be in. The other facility that's over there is the MBB facility. On time, on budget, will open this fall, as the BSL-3 facilities will contain such programs as Karen Ashes, Alzheimer's Disease, the Grossman Memory Center, the Immunology Group with Matt Mesher, and so on, and will provide release space for such programs as the Sulch Diabetes Institute and other people who have been waiting in the wings for more space. I want to make a closing supplication. Interesting word, but I think that's what it is. This is a tough era to be in higher ed. You know, the value of higher ed has dropped. And higher ed is increasingly being considered a personal good as opposed to a public good. So I have to say to you, we're going to engage in a process of tough choices. Down the road, some programs will get investments and grow. Other programs will be the same, and some programs are not going to be here. We have become like a flat egg, and we have to focus if we're not going to move into true mediocrity as a health sciences center. And I'll submit to you, I have no interest in mediocrity. I hope you feel the same way. But we have to get to the point of focusing on where is our excellence going to be, and that's where the investments need to go. So we're initiating an academic health center-wide strategic directions and priorities update, which will get down into each of the schools. I'd like that to be completed by November, December, in time for next year's, for this fiscal year's budgeting process for next year's budget. We need to know what are the strategic priorities and focus, what are we going to accomplish in the next year, and that's what initiates the budget discussions. So budget discussions will be, have you balanced your funds? What's the structural deficit and what's the plan for fixing it? And what's the investment plan for each school and major program in the academic health center? And you're going to see the same across the institution. The challenges are clear. What we need is solutions. So your administrative team is engaged in solutions. But I would say it's your innovation, creativity, and commitment, willing to share and willing to compromise, which is what we need. And it's got to be now, or the window's going to close. If we haven't figured this out by the next biennium, we're in big trouble. I'll tell you why. When we responded to the $90 million of cuts that happened in this institution, 70 plus of which was to give back to the state, there was nothing strategic about it, absolutely nothing. A position that was open stayed and went away, didn't recruit into it. It was real. It was past program, but there was nothing strategic about it. And this academic health center lost 300 plus minus employees, about a third of which were faculty. If we don't figure out what our strategic priorities are and plan around them, we will be in the same position in the next biennium for this particular revenue stream. At the same time, we have to get into the business of looking at other revenue streams and maximizing them and developing new ones, and I would submit there's opportunity there. So there's a time now for leadership. And, you know, my email's secure if you're shy. If you're not, then we ought to engage in open dialogue. And I'll leave you with one thought. The future is ours to make and shape. And if we're 5 years from now in a place that we don't like, we have no further to look than ourselves. So I just leave you with that thought. Now ask away. You got a portable mic? No, I need a portable mic. Thanks.
Okay, it's now.
Shoot.
Two questions. Everything is always, of course, in transformation. And when we reach the, quote, new normal, maybe relative because it's a matter of definition, given that, when do you think, what kind of time frame do you think we will go through to reach this new normal status? And the second question is, do you plan to be on board until then?
It's a great question, Carlos. I'll summarize it this way. We are going to be smaller. And if we only apply a cutting mentality, we'll be smaller, have the same problems, and be worse off. That's not what I'm proposing. What I think we need to do, yeah, we're going to have to shrink, but it's got to be in strategic areas while we invest and grow in other strategic areas. We have to do both in order to end up smaller, but in a better position and more excellent and knowing where we're going. How long do I think that's going to take? The balance the budget proposals that I've seen are on two, sometimes three-year plans. Underneath that, we have to fix the structural issues. We won't be able to do all of that alone. The university is going to have to help us with some of that. Whether we get state money remains an open question, but there are other sources of revenue, more efficient, more effective, more productive. I would submit there's opportunities in e-education, in the clinical practices, and so on, that we're going to have to capture. And we're going to have to move into an all funds. I think it's going to take us, I hope not longer than 2 to 3 years, because we have to pretty well know where we're going in order to plan for the next biennium. We have people online from, what is it, Rochester, Duluth, and St. Paul, too, so don't let me forget to ask for them. Yes.
Hi, Frank. I have, as you know, a lot of concerns, and I'll just raise one of them this morning for the purpose of a dialogue. Did you get a chance to read the paper this morning about Dr.
Oh, I knew you were going to bring this up. Yes, I did.
Did you see the Wall Street Journal article, the New
York
Times article?
Yes, I did.
When we talk about the imprimatur of the University of Minnesota, that imprimatur is very important, and I would suggest to you that one of your highest priorities would be to get this conflict of interest business straightened out. Thank you.
I couldn't agree with you more. You're right on the money. I'll actually go further and say on this particular issue, I think you have been on the money. And I think we're almost there in the new policy proposal. It's got to go through the faculty governance process and that kind of stuff, but it's going to happen. Yeah, one more.
You'll recall that we had a little discussion about this situation with Dr. Pauly giving a lecture in the mini medical school on conflict of interest. And, you know, we really look bad on this, Frank, so I hope we will get this taken care of. It's been 2 years now since we started on this.
Point well made. I'll only say that my feeling on this is, if you really want to get a 360-degree view about what conflict of interest is, you really need to hear multiple points of view, including people who are really engaged in these relationships with big pharma and device companies. It's not a simple solution. And remember, we're not violating a legal statute. This I've lived with in my 40 years of career, starting with the establishment of IRBs, an informed consent. We never did that when I started out. We went to the next level. When brain death came up, we went through it all over again. When cardiac transplants came up, we went through it all over again. And society has again changed its expectations. That's part of what goes into that decision. There are two other pieces. What does this university community want? And the third piece is, what does the institution of the university want? And we're putting those pieces together and beginning the process of developing a new policy. Next. Yes, Patrick?
At the Twin Cities Dean's Retreat a couple weeks ago, the Fitz and
Rosenstone's report on financing the university in the future. We had five items under discussion. I thought it would be nice if you could maybe explain or expound on the covenant that is proposed to be in place between the university and the state government as far as what we do, what they do, and how we might in the future have some more dependable relationship.
I think I know what your reference is to, so I'll start down that path, and if it's not, you'll have to tell me. There's a big concern that is coming out, and I'll give you a brief history. When the higher ed law was in conference committee, there was a put to it from the governor's office, and the put had to do with stem cell research. Now, two things happened. Actually, three. We came out of that with something that didn't really change what we do or how we do it. We've never done somatic cell nuclear transfer and have no intentions of doing it in reproductive cloning. You should also know by university policy, we cannot use state money for embryonal stem cell research. We can use federal money for the federally approved stem cell lines under the new NIH guidelines. And our source of human embryonic stem cells is from embryos from in vitro fertilization that are being discarded and the parents want to voluntarily donate. So you just need to know that. This didn't change any of that, but that's not the issue. The issue was that a particular lobby group wanted to achieve something that they could tout for their own political purposes, and they used the governor and certain of the elected officials to get it. And it entered into the process of trying to define what this institution actually does in research. I think this is the issue you were talking about. This is a big issue, and I'm going to reframe it. My reference was, what you are seeing is the anti-science, anti-intellectual movement encroaching on the autonomy, the constitutional autonomy of this institution. It has the attention of the Board of Regents. It was part of their retreat, and we'll hear a lot more about it. For those of you who don't know, the charter of the university precedes the charter of the state by, I can't remember, 5 or 6 years, something like that. And it's been tested up to the Supreme Court of Minnesota. What it says is there is sufficient knowledge and expertise inside the university that it should determine its own future around education and research. That is what's being challenged. So that's a big issue. The other thing that was in that report, which will become public, probably already is, it can't contain that, is the kind of things I've talked about, but very specifically says the university must engage in a process to determine the scope of its activities. The implication being it has to narrow it. That cover it?
A critical person at the helm is more important when you are changing directions than when you have established a pathway, assuming that that pathway is correct, of course. Do you plan to be at the helm during this transition phase?
Oh, Carlos, you've really become a diplomat. The translation of that is, when am I going to retire? Well done. Let me talk about your concept and my view of succession planning, because I think it's a key question. I don't plan to stay here forever. I promised the president when I took on this joining of these two positions, and if you want to know more about that, I can tell you more. I said I would do it for a minimum of 2 years, because I think it takes that long to accomplish two pieces that I view as critical for succession in a public research institution that is obligated to do national searches for its senior administrators. One, establish a clear corridor that is strategically defined about where we want to go and where we want to be 4 or 5 years from now. That's the process that's now begun. Number two, the stability of transition doesn't reside totally in an individual. It can't in this institution. It resides on the high-performance team that surrounds that individual and that that individual is a part of. So the strategy here, we have a high-performance team in the Academic Health Center. The strategy is to develop a high-performance team in the medical school. And my job is to make sure the same exists in all the other schools. And I can tell you, we're about there. You got most of the deans here, and they've all done that. That makes transitions a lot easier. So when the time comes, you'll be able to recruit somebody into the strategic path. It doesn't mean there won't be some shaping or change or this or that. And they will sit with high-performance teams that have all of the institutional memory about what happened and what the decision-making was and understand the strategic corridor that the future is in. Then you can recruit into that pathway. That's the plan that's in place. Okay? It was well said. Yes? Must be another question or comment. Somebody must disagree. I need to get other people involved. I look at your blog. I know where you are.
Hey, Frank. I've got a philosophical question.
Is the university, I was a philosophy major.
Is the university contributing its erosion value of higher education by having tuition now supersede state support? In other words, we're saddling potential students now with the burden, with our financial burdens.
My opinion is yes and no. In part, it's a reflection of the changing value in the eyes of policymakers and legislators, the changing value of higher ed. And in part, we have played into it in two ways. We have said, if you're not going to give us more state money, or you're going to take it away, we're going to raise tuition. It's the high tuition, high aid game, and I'll come back to that. And the second is, we have had no discipline in the establishment and sunsetting of new programs or existing programs. Zero discipline. I'm talking at a university level, at an academic health center level, and at a school level. It's been entirely non-strategic for the most part. So let me go back and talk now about tuition a little bit. There's an old adage that I'll repeat. Undergraduate students get scholarships. And if you look, if you make up to $100,000 or $150,000, you're not going to pay much tuition. That's how the university systems and the federal systems work. Graduate students get TA-ships and RA-ships. They don't pay tuition. And the professional schools, we get loans. And that's a big problem. When you start seeing students, I actually saw a student with $300,000 worth of loans after 4 years. So that's on the regent's radar, the president's radar, my radar. It's a question we have to contend with and do the elasticity analysis on the front end, do the debt analysis on the back end, and see where we go. I do not see, I'll be real honest with you, a solution in any, I repeat, any of the healthcare reform proposals, including the deal that was made by the three hospital associations and the AAMC. They have agreed to pull $150 billion out of hospital and physician payments. The trade-off, 13,000 new residency positions on the same payment scale as we have today. on which we lose a lot of money and is not being mission-driven. It's not driven by any sense of what are the workforce needs, the sponsors don't get the money, and so on and so forth. And that's an issue that's going to heat up in the next few months, guaranteed. Yes, Calvin.
Hi, Frank, you've described very well our obligation to the state in terms mm-hmm. of what, you know, from a land grant institution perspective. You've also described the continuing reduction in support by the state for the institution. When do those curves cross? When is our obligation altered by the reduction in funds?
It's a great question. Also talked about in the venue Patrick talked about and at the President's retreat. A couple of comments. If you look at the amount of state money per student in public universities, we're still almost on the top of the list. Now, that begs the question that was the other side of the question Dean Lloyd asked, is can we establish a different kind of newer partnership with the state that stabilizes funding? I think if you had a rational executive branch, we could. I'll go back to my other comment illustrating with the stem cell amendment that was put on the higher ed bill. The Democrats just stood around and watched it happen. Who's culpable? That's a question that has not been asked that I think needs to be asked. So having said that, I think that these curves have crossed, and I'll translate that into some question. Let's talk about the medical school, or it could be any other school in the health sciences or the university. If your state money is going down, what is your obligation to take students from Minnesota? That's what this translates into. And our schools vary. They'll go from 60% to 70 or 80%. You can make more money by taking out-of-state students. B, if we're only getting paid this much from the state, maybe that's all we should take. The problem we have, I have no idea what the cost of education is and whether the state money covers it or not, because we can't do the accounting. So that's the first thing that needs to get fixed, and it's being worked on with great focus. So your question is well made, and it's going to have to get in. That's why I'm interested in moving this strategic directions process along. We're going to need these questions for the next budgeting cycle and compact cycle. We've got 1 year before the next biennium. Stuart?
Frank, I have a question looking at the larger context outside the state and what's been going on at the federal level, particularly with healthcare reform. My question arises is, are we positioned as a university and an academic health center to respond to what you see as some of the initiatives coming down the road, particularly things like value-based reimbursement?
My answer is yes and no with a question I'll throw back at you. We have all the tools in the toolbox to respond to anything that comes down the road. Value-based purchasing, interdisciplinary care models, health homes, chronic care prevention and management. We have all of those tools. We are not good at using the tools across discipline to develop and test new models to achieve that. We've got some spotty, stellar results. You read the article about the transitional care unit. Great example of what an interdisciplinary team can do to substantially reduce cost, reduce pharmaceutical errors, and get people home faster and in better shape. That, to me, satisfies the criteria that must be supreme: improve quality, reduce per capita cost. So we have the opportunity to do that. One of my goals for strategic directions is to achieve that opportunity. The question I have back is, I've been asked this question 3 times in the last 2 days. When is the university going to make public, this means health sciences, its view of what healthcare reform should be. Are you game? Want to put the target on? That's what it'll be. Okay, you don't have to answer that today. I saw another question over here.
Frank, could I follow up on this?
Sure.
You answered it in general in terms of the fact that we have strategies, been looking at strategies to how to respond. The question also is, do we have a budgetary model that takes into account the change from fee-for-service to this kind of reimbursement?
Yeah, I would make one correction to that, Stuart. We have a budget model that tells us where the revenue comes from and what we spend it on. That's what, to me, is a budget model. I think what you're talking about is a financial model that gets reflected in the budget model, and I would say today, no. And that's part of what's high on the list when I talk about a new economic model, and it's a task force of people who really want to engage. I've got to get going in the next 4 to 6 weeks. That's the key piece. What are the revenue streams that we have? What are their confidence limits? How do we maximize them? What are the new ones? How do we develop them? Where do we make the investments? Where do we cut the costs? So on and so forth. And it's got to be driven by strategic priorities or we go nowhere. So we got about 6 months to get a lot of this done. I like short timelines because it promotes focus.
Frank, very interesting. You're speaking to the people who...
Where are you? Right. Ah, yes, Warren.
You're talking to the people who want to hear what you're saying. How are you going to get to the people who need to support you? The people who are not here, and even more important, is the medical school students and
yep.
their families. Those are the places where you've got the political support. And you've got to get, I would think, some way, I don't know how, but I see a need for getting more people understanding the message that you have. And we all support you, but we're just a fraction of the medical school.
Yeah, but Warren, you're the most important. Know what I mean? Your question is well, or your comment is well made. The communications plan here is critical. I hate to use the administrative phrase in development, but it actually is. It's under active discussion. Because I think you're right, as the information becomes available, first there's the pulpit, then there's the data and the strategic directions that have to come out over a series of months. And we need a communication strategy that A, gets people's attention, and B, drives it down. And C, promotes a grassroots effort that gets focused on the legislature. Couldn't agree with you more. Got to be done. Don't have the plan today. One last burning question. Well, message is delivered. I'm sure it didn't strike you all as a joyous message. But I think there are some real positive things, and they're all around these new facilities. We have the financial package to fill them with a lot of new faculty, not all, but a lot. We're engaging in a integration strategy with our clinical partners at Fairview that should improve our position in the marketplace, and I think that will benefit all health professional schools. We'll be opening up an office of e-education so that we can leverage that. And we need to engage you in other solutions because you must have good ideas. Warren, you just illustrated that, and I think there are more there. So please let us know them. Otherwise, have a nice day.